This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Amir Questlove Thompson, has made his directorial debut with the new documentary, Summer of Soul. Questlove co-founded The Roots, which is, among other things, the house band for The Tonight Show, where Questlove serves as the music director. He describes his new film as his chance to restore history. The historic but forgotten event the film documents is the 1969 Harlem Cultural Festival, a series of six concerts held in Harlem's Mount Morris Park, which is now called Marcus Garvey Park. It was free and open to the public, and tens of thousands of people attended, mostly black and brown. The roster of performers representing different strains of black and Latino music included Stevie Wonder, Sly and the Family Stone, Nina Simone, B.B. King, Gladys Knight and the Pips, The Fifth Dimension, The Staple Singers, Mahalia Jackson, Ray Barreto, Max Roach, and Abby Lincoln. The festival was 1 year after the assassination of Martin Luther King, during the period of the Black Power movement. The concerts spanned from June 29th to August 24th, overlapping with both the Woodstock Festival and the first Moonwalk. About 40 hours of performances were recorded on video by Hal Tulchin. A couple of hours were shown on local TV in New York, but Tulchin was unable to produce it into a film or TV series in spite of trying for years to attract funders. The tape sat in his basement for about 50 years. Just before his death, he signed over the rights to two producers who brought on Questlove to turn it into the film that is now Summer of Soul. Questlove wrote about the period in black music just after the festival in his book about Soul Train. He has a new book that will be published in the fall called Music is History, focusing on 1971 to the present. Questlove, welcome back to Fresh Air. Congratulations on the film.
Thank you.
It's so great to be able to see this. I mean, it really is a historic document. Now, I'd like to start with a clip of Gladys Knight performing at the festival. And I think this is one of the real standout performances in the movie. And so we'll also hear a little voiceover in this, too.
I bet you're wondering how I do. Baby, baby, that's pain to make me blue. But some other girl you knew before. When I found out yesterday, don't you know that I heard it through the grapevine?
Oh,
not much longer would you be mine.
Don't
you know that I heard it through the grapevine?
Oh, I heard it.
And I'm just about to, about to lose my mind. Oh, yes,
oh,
I am.
Yes, I am.
Oh, yes, I am.
Night was everything to us. She was the queen of soul. She gave it to us good, and the Pips were working.
Oh, yes,
oh, yes, oh, yes.
So, you know, Gladys Knight says in the film that she wasn't expecting such a big crowd. And she seems like so happy to be there. And I think really probably no one knew what to expect. And you probably didn't know what to expect when you started looking at the many hours of video. So when you first started watching these approximately 40 hours of concert footage, what did you find most surprising or most exciting?
I would say probably the Sly and the Family Stone performance is probably the most shocking to watch at the time, because, you know, up until that point, black entertainers were hyper aware of their presence in the world, even if it was the professional sense. And so kind of rule number one was always this sort of unspoken, I come in peace, I'm not a threat kind of disposition that most black people have to have in the workspace, especially during this time period. So Motown was especially known for like sending all their acts to charm school and whatnot, and their whole disposition was basically like, you know, you must wear a tuxedo all the time. And you know, you look at David Ruffin's performance in this film, and he's wearing a wool tuxedo and a coat, like, I mean, scorching in the middle of July. And so the fact that Sly and the Family Stone is performing in their street clothes is such a shock to the audience. Like, to look at anyone over the age of 22, 23, they're looking at them like they're aliens. Like, wait, we never seen an intersectional band. We never seen women play the trumpet. We never seen, why is the, like, a white guy is the drummer in a black group? Like, how good is he if he's that guy? And they're wearing these, they're not wearing suits. What's going on here? And then suddenly to watch them have more excitement than the kids at the end of the set, that should be taught in every university, like on how to really engage and perform and really have a plan that's unmarked and unprecedented and really execute it to perfection.
The festival seemed to mean a lot to the people performing at it. You know, like, Gladys Knight seems like so surprised that there's such a big crowd. And The Fifth Dimension is featured there. And I want to play a little bit of that because Marilyn McCoo, she's the lead singer of the group. She just seems, you film her watching the video of her performance then. And she talks about how important it was for them to perform in front of a black audience, because a lot of people thought they were white because they were considered very middle of the road, songs like Up, Up and Away. So I want to play an excerpt of their performance, of the Fifth Dimension's performance at the Harlem Cultural Festival. And mixed in this will be a clip of Marilyn McCoo watching the Fifth Dimension perform in 1969.
Hey, the sunshine.
All those wonderful gospel licks in his ad-libs. Our producer said, okay, Billy, take it to church. Yeah. And Billy knew exactly what to do because Billy sang gospel in his teen years.
You know, the Fifth Dimension, we travel all over the world. And our main purpose for traveling is just to bring and spread a little love. Ain't nothing wrong with that, is it?
We were constantly being attacked because we weren't quote unquote black enough. Sometimes we were called the black group with the white sound, but we didn't like that. We happen to be artists who are black, and our voices sound the way they sound. And how do you color? That used to be one of our questions. How do you color a sound? That was one of the reasons why performing in Harlem was so important to us. Mm-hmm. Because we wanted our people to know what we were about. Mm-hmm. And we were hoping that they would receive us.
So that was Marilyn McCoo and Billy Davis speaking over their performance, over the Fifth Dimension's performance of The Age of Aquarius, which was a big hit for them. I had no idea that they had been confused for white, that they felt so bad about not getting recognition from black audiences. It was very moving to see the significance that this had for her and for Billy Davis. And it just made me think about what it meant to the performers to be at the festival. Did you play the tape back for all the performers to get their reaction?
Pretty much. You know, a lot of it was just to jog their memory. That particular moment that we just saw with Marilyn McCoo, I realized something. You know, it was sort of an unplanned question. And I guess when I saw an entry, I investigated further, only because it's what I recognized in myself and my own career. I was commenting to Billy Davis that, you know, in all the performances I've seen of the Fifth Dimension, I've never heard you use sort of your gospel growl, your James Brown sermon preacher, hey, dig it, you know, that sort of thing. And he was just joking, like, because I was happy. Like, we've never been in front of a crowd like this before. So it brought out my inner gospel preacher thing. And in Merlin McCoo, you know, it just opened the door because I realized that, oh, so this is sort of like when the Roots are performing and, you know, one night we're with Beck. The next night we're with Wu-Tang Clan. One night we're with, you know, like Soundgarden. The next night, or Rage Against the Machine. The next night we're with, a Tribe Called Quest or the Fugees. And there's sort of, again, a code switching is sort of the overall theme for a lot of these black performers, where you have to change your presentation to fit the situation that you're in, to make the audience feel comfortable with you and for you to feel comfortable. And sometimes it's exhausting. So when you see her cry, it's relief of finally being accepted by your own people, which is important, but it's also, it's very exhausting, you know, like it's juggling plates in the kitchen, like 20 plates at a time. So I believe that when you see her crying, that's the exhaust feeling of a life of code switching, sort of to make people comfortable.
So I have to talk to you a little bit more about clothes. Because we see a whole range of clothes in the documentary. So the Fifth Dimension is wearing yellow shirts with orange vests that I think were fringed, with red ties and blackish bell bottoms with stripes going down the side. And it's just an era where, like, fashion is really changing. Some of the collars are huge.
Very huge, yes.
Big collars are coming in. And some of the, you know, performers are dressed very basically, like Gladys Knight is wearing, you know, like a skirt and a top, and the Pips are wearing like beige matching suits. So what are your thoughts now about dressing on stage, how you want to be? Do you think you've changed at all?
You know, there's part of me that wants to look semi-professional because, you know, we're 50 now. You know, we just started doing our first shows in 16 months, like a week ago. And, you know, we're all different people now than we were before we went into quarantine. So I myself was wondering, for like this new album that we're doing, like, what do we present? Do we dress our age, or are we still like jeans and t-shirts? Like, what are we? So we're still trying to figure that out right now. But, you know, I still have my afro and there's still holes in my jeans, and I love wearing ironic t-shirts. So for the time being, yes, we're still in our street clothes.
What about the comb in your hair? It's not,
you know,
it's not there anymore, is it?
I kind of retired it, not even as a mission statement. I just think I got tired of searching for it, like the panic of, I got to go back and get my afro pick was really just getting on my nerves. So I just stopped wearing it. And when I was quarantining, I pretty much been wearing my hair in braids just so I wouldn't have to deal with the nightmare of doing my hair for an hour every day. Occasionally I'll bring my afro out, but I'm kind of enjoying the anonymity of what life was like, wearing a mask and have my hair braided, like, the places I could go to and not be recognized. Like, it's been kind of awesome. So I'm enjoying my newfound freedom without looking like Questlove.
Yeah, so is it hard to not look like Questlove sometimes? Do you know what I mean? Because when how you look becomes almost a brand, yeah, there's a lot of resistance to changing it from fans.
Yeah, I get the occasional, okay, we get it. Like, can you bring your afro back? But, you know, I think I'm defiantly sort of in this thing where it's like, I'm not my afro. Like, I know you guys like think of
yeah,
afro, Lego heart pick. So now that, you know, especially just the person that I morphed into in this past year, I'm kind of enjoying him. You know, at first it was just convenience. Like, okay, I'm going to not wear my afro, wear my hair in braids, just wear, you know, dashikis and pajamas and sweats and Crocs and I became the man that I used to laugh at a lot.
Why were you laughing at that man?
Well, you know, just, you know, all my friends were like, you know, like, yeah, we live in a farm and or we live upstate in a cabin and we do yoga every morning and we take morning walks. And, you know, I used to just behind their backs like, like, that'll never be me. Like, I'm gonna live in my bachelor pad in my, you know, my cozy 73rd floor apartment and all that stuff. But I took an assessment of what my life was during quarantine, and now I too own a farm.
You do?
Yeah, during quarantine, my girlfriend and I got a spot upstate New York. Words I thought I'd never say in this lifetime, and I'm really enjoying it. Like, I like the quiet. I didn't think I liked the quiet. I thought I had to be in proximity of a 24-hour pharmacy just in case of an emergency, that sort of thing. But no, I kind of like the isolation and the serenity of it all. I didn't realize that would serve me. I thought, like, chaos was the only way that I could exist. But now I embrace quiet, and I can hear myself think.
Do you have animals on the farm?
Not animals that I want. I mean, my girlfriend made me get two cats to teach me empathy, which is helping. So I'm a cat dad. However, every day there's new fawn, new deer, way more rabbits than I'd like to see on my property. So yeah, I'm surrounded by animals, even though there are none that I've purchased or own myself. They're just there every day.
I have to say, my cat is not famous for empathy. So my cat would not be a good teacher.
We got our kittens like 20 days after they were born, so they don't know how to be too cool for school yet.
So why do you need to be taught empathy?
The last year has really been a big lesson for me in terms of, like, self-love, in terms of, you know, I was world famous for being a machine. You know, last time I was there, I'm sure we talked about me having 19 jobs and really not making time for myself, but, like, always, like, trying to fill the day with more jobs and more jobs and more jobs and more jobs. Because even as a machine, as a 19-job machine workhorse, you know, my attitude was often like, well, I'm an expert at this thing, so listen to me, and da-da-da-da. Just because I churn out great product might not necessarily mean that I'm also pleasurable to work with or really good at communicating or expressing emotions and feelings and all those things. And so I'm sure that's the seed that was planted to get to this point. I wouldn't even hesitate to say that had this not happened, I would have probably been on an express lane to the next life.
Really?
You know, and as you can see with all my peers in hip hop, a lot of us, like, we thought that not getting shot in the club was the victory. Like, okay, I'm 35 now. I'm too old to get shot in the club. Because that was always a concern in the 90s. Now, there's a new getting shot in the club, which is strokes, cardiac arrest, like our mental health and whatnot. So it's a wonder that a lot of us can't even get past the age of 60. Like, so many of my peers in hip hop are succumbing at 52, 53, 54, 50, like in their 50s, like 10 a year. So It's a fight to the finish. I'm at probably the best place I am right now. Like, I've lost over 100 pounds. Happier. You know, I'm happy to be alive.
It's just been great to talk with you again.
Well, I thank you for having me, and I really enjoy doing your show all the time. Thank you.
Amir Questlove Thompson directed the new documentary Summer of Soul, which you can see in theaters and streaming on Hulu. Now we're going to remember two early electric guitarists born on the same day in July 100 years ago. George Barnes and Mary Osborne were both white Midwesterners who learned early on from their fathers, were mentored by African-American pioneers, and appeared on radio as teenagers before moving on to success in New York. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead has this appreciation, starting with some music from George Barnes.
George Barnes, 1946, showing off the swoops and spiky attack that made him a favorite of pickers like jazz's Herb Ellis and country music's Merle Travis and Chet Atkins. Barnes grew up in Chicago, learning to play from his father. An older brother built him a pickup and amplifier before any were commercially available, making George one of the first electric guitarists, and a precocious one. African-American picker Lonnie Johnson helped school him in the blues. When Barnes was 16, he played on a flurry of sessions with black singers that helped set the template for Chicago band blues. Here's George Barnes in 1938 behind Big Bill Brunzi.
Ooh, baby, that's all right for you. Baby, that's all right, baby. I mean that way you. Mr. Man.
Still in his teens, George Barnes began playing and arranging music for radio, skills that served him well in New York studios later. Right after World War II, he led a whimsical Raymond Scott-like octet, playing musical clockworks like Intricacies of a Threshing Machine. George Barnes moved to New York in the 50s and immediately got busy in recording and broadcast studios, playing on literally thousands of sessions. He's in the band on Bob Dylan's first single, 1962's Mixed Up Confusion. In the 60s, Barnes made a frantic multiple guitar album and played in guitar duos with Carl Kress or Bucky Pizzarelli. In his last years in the 70s, Barnes co-led a relaxed quartet with cornetist Ruby Braff. Our other 100th birthday guitarist, Mary Osborne, came up in the boom town of Minot, North Dakota. She picked up her dad's facility with stringed instruments early and started appearing on radio, singing and playing guitar. The teenage Osborne played a little jazz on violin until she heard Oklahoma's Charlie Christian play electric guitar with a band in Bismarck. In no time, she bought one of her own and was sitting in, learning at his side. She and Charlie became friends despite differences in age and race in the 1930s heartland. Charlie Christian showed Mary Osborne how to solo as if guitar were a horn, a linear approach with some voice-like inflections. ¶¶ Mary Osborne on Blues and Mary's Flat, 1946. By the early 40s, she'd moved to New York, playing jam sessions in 52nd Street clubs. She got spotted by one jazz elder on the lookout for youngsters with new ideas, saxophonist Coleman Hawkins. This is his Spotlight from 1946, when the guitarist was 24. Mary Osborne turned up on records by, among others, singers Ethel Waters and Mel Torme, bluesman Winoni Harris, pianist Mary Lou Williams, and drummers Gene Krupa and Louis Belson. Osborne later said she encountered little overt sexism on the New York scene, but she made too few records of her own, a batch of singles and a nice 1959 LP, dubiously titled A Girl and Her Guitar, with Tommy Flanagan on piano, and Joe Jones on drums. Osborne was a regular on New York radio and played on some locally televised jam sessions in the 1950s. Some of those jams are on YouTube, including an I Surrender Dear, where she stretches out as Billie Holiday looks on. But in the 60s, Osborne felt burnt out, like she'd already played it all, and she and her husband moved to California. She still did gigs near home in Bakersfield or in Los Angeles, and on rare occasions, someone would coax her back east to play or record, as old friend Marion McPartland did in 1977. Mary Osborne died in 1992, 15 years after her contemporary George Barnes. Two guitarists worth celebrating.
Kevin Whitehead is the author of the book Play the Way You Feel, The Essential Guide to Jazz Stories on Film. He remembered guitarists George Barnes and Mary Osborne. This month marks the 100th anniversary of their birth. Utopian communities are of special interest to my guest Akash Kapoor because he grew up in one. He's seen the idealism of people trying to remake human society and renounce materialism. He's also seen how idealism and spirituality can turn into zealotry, and how individuals can become victims of their own search for perfection. Children, he writes, are often the worst victims of such communities. His parents were pioneers of the utopian community Auroville in India. It was founded in 1968 with the goals of encouraging humanity and advancing the spiritual evolution of humanity. The spiritual leader, known as the Mother, believed in a system of yoga that would enable the practitioner to achieve, quote, cellular transformation and immortality. Kapoor left that world when he was 16 to attend the prestigious boarding school Phillips Academy Andover. It was on to Harvard after that. Well, in the U.S., he ran into a woman who also grew up in Auroville and went to college in the U.S. They'd known each other only slightly growing up. They fell in love and married and for reasons Kapoor will explain, moved back to Oroville and have been raising their two children there. Oroville is very different now from the time he was a child. He's written a new book called Better to Have Gone, Love, Death, and the Quest for Utopia in Oroville. The book is part history, part memoir, and part the story of his wife's parents, who both died there under unusual circumstances when she was 14. Kapoor is also the author of India Becoming, A Portrait of Life in Modern India, and he's the editor of an anthology of writings about Oroville. He's the former Letter from India columnist for the International New York Times and has also written for The New Yorker. As a result of the pandemic, he and his family have been living in New York since November. Akash Kapoor, welcome to Fresh Air. Before we get to more specifics about Oroville, you've written extensively about utopian communities and the ideals that create them and the things that go wrong once they're created. And why do you continue to be so interested in these experiments of utopian communities?
Well, I think there are many reasons. I mean, for one thing, there's a sort of personal connection, obviously, having grown up in one. But I also just think, you know, there's a quote by Ralph Waldo Emerson, who was writing about Brook Farm, which was a 19th century intentional community in Massachusetts. And he described it as a French Revolution in small, an age of reason in a patty pan. And I think that, like, a lot of the sort of like the grand currents of humanity, a lot of the sort of like the ideological sort of, you know, big themes of history and the impulses of humankind often play out in these small communities. So like when I was thinking of this book, I was thinking, is this just about one small community in India? And the more I thought about it, it just felt like this sort of impulse to reinvent, to build a better world, to sort of perfect humankind is very much like a universal impulse. And people, you know, people manifest it in different ways in their lives, whether it's like sell the house and like move to Tahiti or whatever. But we're often trying to just like build a better world. And that process is often a lot more complicated than we imagine it's going to be. You know, dreams sort of crash against reality. And I guess that's what interests me about these places.
1968, the year Oroville was founded, was a year in which so many people in the U.S. were trying to create utopian communities, hippie communes. Would you describe Oroville when it was founded and what the founding principles were?
It wasn't a coincidence that Oroville was founded in 1968 because it really was part of that kind of efflorescence of intentional communities and communes that came up in the 1960s and in many ways was sort of part of that ideology and that urge to reinvent the world. So, you know, Oroville was a little bit different because it was in India as opposed to the Western world where many of these communes were. And so it had a strong kind of spiritual basis. Some of it was based on Indian spirituality. The broad principles were foster human unity, create sort of new models of economy or society. I mean, there was a very strong anti-materialist emphasis to the community. It also was founded on very strong sort of ecological principles, which became stronger over time. And then part of the spiritual idea in it was this idea of spiritual evolution, the idea that sort of man was not the final stage of evolution and that human evolution could somehow be willed through a more disciplined spiritual practice.
Why did your parents move there? And I should mention that your father, as you write, grew up in a Hindu family who lived in Pakistan but was forced to flee to India during the partition in 1947. They lost everything in the process. And your mother was from Minnesota, a small farming town there, and an Irish Catholic family. So how did they end up moving to this utopian community, Oroville?
A lot of people moved there because they were fueled by sort of the general idealism of the 60s, and they were inspired by this idea that, like, really they could reinvent the world. I mean, you know, I remember when I was a kid, my father used to often say to me, he would say, we really thought that we were going to, like, start a revolution that was going to change the world. And I don't think that was particular to Oroville. I think that was the ethos of the 60s. So the kind of, like, specific answer is that, you know, my father was a student at the University of Denver, and he and my mom met at an anti-Vietnam War rally in Denver. And then it's like, next thing you know, they're taking this grand overland trip. My mom's never been out of the U.S. before because she grew up in this small farming town, and they're living in a hut by the edge of a field, part of this sort of like you know, crazy grand experiment to remake the world.
What did your grandparents think of your parents moving to the, you know, becoming pioneers in this community?
Well, from my father's side, like his parents, after having lost everything in partition, they sort of had made their way down to the south of India and were actually living in the ashram, the spiritual community founded by the mother and Sri Aurobindo. So I think for them, this was less of a sort of leap, right? Whereas I think for my mom's parents, I mean, I think it was novel would be a sort of one way to put it. But I think, you know, my dad always said that they were incredibly tolerant and accepting of it. And I don't know, maybe again, it was the 60s. People did wild things in those days, and they seemed less wild than they might now.
So I want to ask you about your wife's story, because like you, she grew up in Oroville. Her parents both died there when she was 14. Her mother was in a horrible accident when she was climbing up scaffolding, participating in the building of what was to be a kind of centerpiece of the community, a spiritual building, basically dedicated to the founder of the community, who was known as the mother. She fell off the scaffolding and was terribly injured. She broke her jaw, she broke her back, and ended up being paralyzed from the waist down after that. And after that happened, after the accident, she was told by one of the spiritual leaders of the community not to seek medical help, but to just basically seek spiritual help. So how did she handle that advice?
I think the short answer is badly, and I don't think it went very well, because, you know, this, in some ways, this is sort of like the heart of the book, because I think that she was a woman who had suffered a horrible accident, who had suffered a horrible tragedy. And instead of being able to sort of process it and deal with it as a tragedy, there was this whole web of symbolism and meaning constructed around it. And she was essentially told not only that, you know, she should reject medical care and that she would sort of heal herself through yoga and through spiritual practice, but that the community, which at that time was going through a very rough time when there were all these divisions, that somehow the healing of the community was linked to her healing. And I think it was just, you know, too much weight to put on one person's shoulders, especially somebody who had just suffered a horrible tragedy like that.
So she raised Aurelise, who is now your wife, while being like incapacitated. And her partner had to carry her even if she was going to the bathroom. It's not like she had a wheelchair or any kind of device to help her. So she was really dependent on him. And then he got really sick. And he eventually just died. And then what happened after that?
What happened after that is that Aurelise's mother, Diane, was left on her own. And she had been utterly dependent, as you said, on John. In addition to being utterly dependent, I think they felt that they had been on this kind of grand spiritual sort of quest together, and she wanted to sort of like join him. So the same day that he died, that afternoon, she swallowed poison from a plant growing outside her house, and she died from the poison that she ingested.
If you don't mind my asking, how does your wife feel knowing that her mother died by suicide, knowingly leaving behind a 14-year-old daughter with no family in India?
It's, you know, it's what you would expect. It's very difficult. Of course it's a form of abandonment, and of course it feels like a form of abandonment. At the same time, I think that my wife understands that her mother was in, you know, tremendous distress, and she knew the sort of like distress and suffering she had gone through. And frankly, part of the process of healing was writing this book and researching this book, because, you know, she sort of knew the broad outlines of these deaths, but she didn't know the details, and she didn't know what had sort of led them to this point. And there were many conversations we had while I was researching the book, where I would sort of find out things about what had led to this point, and we would sort of talk about it and process it together. My wife is a very wise, strong, well-balanced person, having come through some real hardship.
So what made you both decide that you were going to move back to Oroville, considering how traumatic some of her memories are from there and the mixed feelings that you had about Oroville?
I mean, people often ask us that. I mean, I say somewhere in the book that children of utopian communities are often like exiles. And I think what I mean by that is that you grow up with this sort of like dream in your head and this vision of a more perfect world. And you believe it very much when you're a kid. You believe that that's real. And then you get older and you sort of realize, oh, you know, life's more complicated and these things, like, they're hard to work out and they often don't work out. But there's a part of your brain and more relevantly, your dreams or your imagination that sort of like cling to that idea, even if it's not very conscious. And so I believe that that was part of our move back, that we sort of wanted to be somewhere where it felt like, oh, people are trying to build a new world. People are trying to build a better world. People are rejecting, you know, materialism. And maybe that was naive. You know, it's not like it got any easier 20 years down the line when we were adults. But I do think that part of us still clung to that. And I will say that for Orlise, of course, again, probably unconsciously, there was all this, you know, unfinished business to be worked out. She didn't know how they had died. I don't think she felt like she wanted to know at that point, but I suspect that that was part of the impetus that drove us back.
Oroville is now over 50 years old, which is a long time for a utopian community. How does Oroville of today compare to your memories of childhood?
No, people, life has gotten easier. It's less the you know, one of the great changes and the most sort of positive changes in Oroville is that this barren desert plateau has been turned into an amazing forest. I mean, Oroville's ecological work is sort of probably one of the most successful reforestation projects in India. So the physical landscape has changed a lot. A lot of that extremism, I wouldn't say is completely gone. I mean, you know, certainly the types of people who are attracted to these types of communities are firm believers. And so there are certainly people who still believe very strongly and very firmly. But the community's grown bigger and those forces sort of dissipate more through the wider community. So they're still there, but the community as a whole is less doctrinaire and there's less zealotry now.
How are you raising your children in Oroville compared to how you were raised there?
Well, I think we're much more conventional. I think the community is much more conventional, for better and for worse. The schools are much more solid. They're great in many ways. They're multicultural. They have, because, you know, Oroville's a very diverse community. It has, you know, people from more than 100 countries. And so their classes are very multicultural. The system of education is still more, I guess you would say, open than or flexible than a conventional system. Like, they don't get graded. They don't have exams. The purpose of education is not necessarily to just, like, you know, get into college or whatever. So it's a little looser than a traditional school, but it's a lot more solid than it was when we were kids.
You write that growing up in, quote, utopia is a good way to make you an incrementalist. Can you expand on that?
You know, I've written about this elsewhere and in the context of sort of contemporary situation in the world, because I think that we're in a moment now. Let's put it this way. Historically, utopias have often emerged from very disorienting and sort of disturbed times. So, you know, like, okay, the Renaissance, which was a form of utopia, emerged from the Black Death. After the Civil War in America, there was this huge efflorescence of intentional communities across the country. And then, you know, a lot of what we think of as 60s communities actually started in the 50s. And I think they really emerged from kind of the detritus of World War II, where everything that we had taken for granted was sort of shattered and all norms felt worthless and thrown out the window. And I think that it's possible that we're living through such a moment again now where everything just feels like we've sort of hit a wall, like the existing solutions don't really work. And I certainly see signs on all sides of the political spectrum of casting about for sort of dramatic reinvention and dramatic change. And I understand that. And I myself feel that we've hit a wall. But, you know, I'm also, I guess because of my own biography, it makes me a little nervous and I'm a little skeptical of it, because I know how these things often end badly. And it's interesting because people have reacted sometimes negatively to it, right? Because the moment is not really, you know, they don't, it's not in favor of incrementalism. The moment's in favor of radical change.
Where do your parents live now?
My parents are both in Oroville.
Oh, so they're both in the community?
Yes, they both are.
How well did your parents know your wife's parents?
Oh, they knew each other pretty well. They were, you know, it was a small community, and everybody knew everybody. And I describe a scene in the book that my mom told me, where she remembers having a conversation with my wife's mother. This is before she'd had her accident. They were having coffee together or something, and she says she remembers two kids on little wooden scooters, shirtless, sort of scurrying around the floor, and that was my wife and me. So, you know, we have no memory of that moment, but as I say, it was sort of like the inception of a friendship that we wouldn't remember, but that would last a lifetime.
Well, Akash Kapoor, I want to thank you so much for talking with us, and I wish you and your family well.
Thank you, Terry. That was fun.